Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality and wider afield. We look at issues of economics, politics, environment, but most importantly, we're about solutions and hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and joined as always by my alter ego and co-host, Tony Groves. Tony, how are you?
I am very good, Rory. I was out with your good friend from your old days, Lynn Rowan, last night. She said to say we weren't really good friends, though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Listen, folks, bit of housekeeping. Live show next Tuesday in the Wiley Fox with a panel including Lorcan Sir, Orla Hegarty, and Hugh Brennan from O'Coolon. And we are going to go big on housing there. Rory, you had a great article in the Indo about it yesterday. It is the thing that's affecting us all. If you want any more detail, head over to our patreon.com/tortoiseshack.
Yeah, no, thanks, Tony. We're joined today, delighted to be joined by Independent Senator Colette Kelleher, who is a member of the Civil Engagement Group. And Colette is a former head of Cork Simon and lifelong activist, campaigner, social campaigner. Colette, we're delighted to have you with us.
Good morning. Lovely to be here.
Great. Colette, I was talking to you before, and I've worked with you over the last while on various issues, and I've been very impressed with how you have an aura about you, which is one of, deep commitment and passion to social change and social justice. And I wonder if you could maybe explain a little bit about, where that came from.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I grew up in a small town, and I guess there was really very little difference between, public and private space, really. Mm. We had a shop. So, the people came in the door to you, and you were on the street, and you were connected into, your family, but also your community. Yeah. So you got kind of involved from an early age. And I suppose one of the things I remembered when I was kind of reflecting on this was my dad. He died when I was 11.
Yeah.
And, yeah. One of the first things that I remember, and it came to me when I was actually doing the family reunification bill around refugees and reconnecting with family members, was the first time I heard the word refugees was going with my father. I was about six, I think, to Kilworth Camp, where a lot of people had come from the north,
yeah,
because of the Troubles. And my dad, who was a man who left school at 12, but had a great heart and was really intelligent man, went down with parcels of meat. We had a butcher shop.
Yeah.
And I was with him. And I was half afraid. I didn't know what I was going into. Mm. We went into this camp in the middle of, an army camp is kind of a strange place anyway. But it was all these children and people. And that was the first time I heard refugee. So I guess there would have been that kind of spirit and ethos in our house. My parents were very ordinary people, weren't activists in any way. But I suppose you saw kind of kindness and decency at an early age. And then I did social science in UCC. Mm. We had our 40th anniversary of our first year. So, no spring chicken here. And I suppose what we were exposed to, it was a very political course actually at the time. And one of the things that always kind of stayed with me was that all private problems are public issues, the C. Wright Mills sociological imagination.
Yeah.
And that actually has made sense all through my working life, whether it was as a community worker in Finglas or kind of working on early years in England or homelessness and other issues. So instead of seeing things being to do with people's personal failures, you were always putting things into the context in which those situations and challenges arose for people, and always looking at things from both the personal impact, but also the structural and social causes for those things. So that kind of, I suppose, has helped me make sense of a very kind of diverse working life.
Yeah. And in terms of the, interesting to say, look over those 40 years, do you see that this kind of, which you could broadly describe as, the Thatcherite neoliberal idea that, poverty, inequality, it is people's individual fault. They're, they decide their life trajectories. And do you think that that has become more and more dominant in the sense of, do people believe it and buy into it?
Most definitely. I think that whilst issues do bear down on people as individuals. There's no doubt about that. And those challenges and traumas that people experience have to be responded to on an individual basis. There is no doubt in my mind that so much is generated, so much is created, socially constructed, and that there are always things that we can do as a society if we so choose. But victim blaming is very prevalent. And I think, there's a huge language associated with neoliberalism. Again, when I worked in various voluntary organisations getting funding from government, talk about business planning. I hate the fact that the language of the market has crept into what is about care, what is about rights, what is about support. And it just frames how you think about things. So I do think that there has been, a shift in how we consider the challenges and situations. And of course you can see that in housing somehow, that if you don't have a roof over your head, it's your fault. And that is so not true and so not fair. But it's also something that we didn't always think even in Ireland. We were building houses in the 30s, in the 50s, in the 70s. We've got completely caught up in this market is the only way to solve housing, and we need to shift away from it because it's clearly not working.
Because I was going to ask you that, why you're in the housing committee in the Oireachtas now, and you've been in the Seanad since 2016. So you've seen the rollout of Rebuilding Ireland, consistent government commitments to building social housing, yet we've seen it's nothing close to what's actually required. Why have the government not built social housing?
I think there's an ideological and an institutional bias against building social housing. I think there's huge vested interest in maintaining the market model. I mean, if you think about the transfers from the state to private landlords under the housing assistance payments HAP, it's massive. Yeah. It's a huge transfer of public money, which could be spent elsewhere. So, there are huge vested interests in maintaining the status quo. I mean, if you have a house or you're renting a house, it's, happy days. So why would you want anything to change? Scarcity has been good for some. Yeah. But it's been absolutely devastating for so many, including our youngest and children. 3,800 is the current number and growing. Children born into that circumstances, what an awful start in life. And we know that those children are far more likely to be homeless themselves. So not only are we ruining people's today, those children's today, but we're also damaging their prospects in life, their life chances into the future, which I think is very, very wrong. I think it's immoral.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. And I can see, you visually there getting upset, and it is upsetting. And I was walking down Gardiner Street the other day, and I saw a family, young child in a school uniform going into one of the hostels with their parents. I saw another child and their parents sitting on the road, and you could see they were clearly in a situation of homelessness. They had a tent beside them. And it is deeply upsetting. And I think, it raises the question to me, how can we as a society, has it become normalised? Have we accepted it? Or is it a case that the political system, the government, is still in denial, but the people are still feel that, most people feel this is wrong and it needs to change? And is the government going to get a big kick on it, do you think, in the election?
Well, I think it is becoming normalised. And I do think denial is at play as well. There is a sense that I think, oh my God, it's so intractable. And I think that's one of the downsides for campaigning around, campaigning around the figures and putting it out there. Because when you do that, first of all, we get used to it. We get used to, 3,800 children now. It'd be 4,000 before long. It'll be 5,000. Oh, well, hopefully it won't, but it could be. And people just get inured to the figures, and people forget that figures are people. people. Mm. So on one hand, when you are telling it how it is, there's also the normalization, and then it becomes an enormous task. Mm. And then it becomes, it's something that we actually can't solve when we actually can. We're a very rich country. We were building houses in the 30s, in the hungry 70s, in the bleaker 50s, and actually Dr. Carlo Connell in UCC has done a fantastic paper, which I was privileged to listen to, kind of tracking, you know, the course and discourse on housing. Mm. What he was saying was that, you know, De Valera, because in Britain they were building houses. Mm. De Valera felt, well, we should be building houses as well. Yes. So a lot of it is mindset. It's political will. And I think we can and should build social housing. Social housing has been demonised, I think, very unfairly. Yeah. And we need to get rid of that. And I mean, we had in Britain, you know, there's been really interesting kind of podcasts on, you know, sink estates, even that idea. Yeah. When actually they're fine places to live, and why wouldn't they be?
Well, I would say there's two things, and Rory, it goes back to your question as well, Rory, about, you know, are the public oblivious or are the government going to get a kick in? First and foremost, I saw Saoirse McHugh asked on social media recently, you know, why is this happening? What is Owen Murphy doing? And I would argue that Owen Murphy's doing a great job, because his idea, his job in effect, is actually to keep it off balance sheet and keep arm's distance from the state away from social housing, as we call it. And we got to stop calling social housing. We need public housing for open to all. And that's a great job, because he's keeping it off balance sheet, because they're putting it out to this model now of private, you know, land transfer.
That's
and
right.
Then through, and then via HAP. He's a big success. Yeah. And we talked about, you used the word earlier, Rory, they're not building enough. Even of what they're building, 71% that it is HAP, and they call it build. Yeah. You know, once it's enhanced lease, it counts as a new build, even though it's not physically bricks and mortar.
And if you look at all the new builds in Cork, it's either apartments for private sale or student accommodation, where you have huge profits to be made. So, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I since I've joined the housing committee, the land development, I mean, I'm surprised there aren't kind of riots on the street about the land development agency, because it's this massive transfer of public assets that we all own. 1.3 billion for starters, land that's held by the army, the HSE, hospitals, other local authorities. And for that, you know, the idea is that we'll get 150,000 houses, 15%, 10%, 15,000 houses will be in public ownership. Mm. That to me is a very bad deal. And I'm surprised there isn't war over it.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that has just gone through the Housing Committee at the moment, in the process of, they're setting up the legislation would enact the Land Development Agency, put it into law. And within that, the proposal in the legislation itself, is it going to stipulate?
No, it's not.
The what percentage of the use of the public land?
No, so there's still a possibility that equation of, you know, 10% social, 30% affordable, whatever that means.
Yes, of course.
You know, affordable as...
They've redefined that.
Yeah. And I mean, affordable, as somebody said at the committee, is whatever you can afford to pay. Mm. You know, so affordable doesn't mean...
The market price,
exactly.
Or 20% below the market.
And then the other 40% is, the other 60%. And then is private.
By definition, which is also unaffordable.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So I think it's a really bad idea, and I think it's a really bad deal, and I don't think we should do it. I'm not sure that the legislation will actually get through in this parliament. But I'm surprised at how little people know. You know, I was chatting about it with friends, and people were saying, really? Oh, I didn't know about that. Really? That's terrible. You know, and so I do think there is a lot of work to be done in highlighting, you know, all the things that are going on and going around housing and how they work and how they don't work.
Yeah, no, and I think it's interesting that the O'Devany Gardens case has actually you know, increased awareness of what is actually happening in public land. And I think, you know, and as Tony said, I wrote about it in the Independent yesterday in terms of...
It was a great
of,
article.
Thank you.
I wrote most of it. He just took my ideas.
Tony likes to wish.
So you're the ghostwriter.
He wishes. The point being that these public-private partnerships that they're using, which is essentially the model that they're rolling out, that... First of all, as an approach, it hands over our public land to these private developers and private finance, who will build if it's profitable. And if house prices fall, or if, you know, cost of finance goes up, they won't build and nothing will happen. As we saw in 2008. And the other thing is, as you say, you have this mix where half the land or more is handed over to build private unaffordable housing.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like the obvious
thing. And why
thing,
would we be doing that?
Why would we, when we've this housing crisis, which everybody knows at the heart of it is the lack of supply of affordable housing, we have public land. Why do we not build completely 100% affordable housing, public housing? We've a Coolong cooperative on it.
Yes, that's a good question. And I think, you know, so I think it is mindset. And as I said, it is vested interest. There's an awful lot of people doing well out of the housing crisis.
Yes.
So we have to recognise that. So those vested interests will be wanting to keep the status quo as it is, because there is huge profits to be made, both as kind of institutional landlords, but also small landlords, individual landlords. So it's massive return on capital in housing at the moment.
Which is... Again, and it's important that listeners understand this. This is not just, we're not just saying this. The government's own, the IGES report, the evaluation report said this is economically wrong, where, you know, for every HAP tenancy in Dublin,
we can build
two affordable homes.
Oh, it's very bad value for money.
And so we're, so that money's obviously, as I said, we're not, and some of this money's not being taxed because it's going to REITs and it's going to these funds.
Investment funds.
Yeah. And more importantly, in that stipulation, again, in the same report, they said, actually, what's happening here is a socioeconomic, I'm going to use the word apartheid, but they used exclusion, it meant gentrification, that these rents were pushing people out. And that's what we're facing here. So it is, their own reports are saying, don't do this.
Yeah, no, it's bad economics.
Yeah.
And also, you know, you think about it, and I've been, Rory and I are part of the Home for Good coalition, which is arguing for a right to housing, which is an important, I think, floor and kind of a guarantee for Irish citizens that, you know, that people can, rely on the state to provide a secure home over your head. Obviously, by itself, it will, you know, it has to work alongside, you know, public investment and public housing and all of the rest. But it is an important part of the puzzle, and it's a missing part of the puzzle. But like what I keep raising and at those meetings is that the housing crisis, whilst it is benefiting some hugely, it's also really undermining, you know, our economic prosperity. Because again, I see the Chamber of Commerce in Cork for the last number of years, they do a survey of their members and they would ask them what are their biggest challenges, and housing supply and the fact that they can't get people to work in expanding, you know, when these companies come to Cork and they're trying to recruit, they are hampered by the fact that those people can't find places to live. So it's, and that will hold us back. You know, some people would argue about whether we should be, you know, in an economic growth kind of model anyway. Mm. But like, given that, you know, people need jobs and people need to work in jobs, it's going to really hamper our ability to generate kind of growth and development. And it is already having an impact. Mm.
And it does go back to, in a way, like the fundamentals of, you know, social policy and around understanding what role does the state play in
Absolutely.
An economy. And Fine Gael, Gael's view is the very, you know, the market is the predominant player and the state basically plays the role of supporting the market and you provide some level of welfare to the deserving poor. And when you look at the most successful economies are the ones where the state plays a huge role, like in the likes of the Nordics. And housing is the best example of that. If
Absolutely.
You allow it to the market, it will actually undermine all your other aspects of society and your economy, because the market only builds what's profitable. But housing housing is not just about, if you allow that, we were in this crisis we're in, which is a market dominated one. But the question then comes back is that, okay, well, what should the state do? And the state needs to build. Like, there's no other way around it. And they've caught themselves in this as this kind of trap where they're on the one hand, they're trying to, you know, say, well, we're going to boost supply. Because part of the argument of the use of public land, they're not thinking about, oh, how could we build social housing? What they're thinking is, how can we use this to boost the property market? Mm. How can we help developers get going again?
Mm.
That's part of why absolutely. They're using this public, which is, like, it's absolutely ludicrous when you look at it.
And we've had chronic market failure. I mean, you know, I don't know how much more evidence, you know, we had the crash, we built, the houses were built, they were built very often in the wrong place, for people. And we had the whole thing of ghost estates. So we've had, like, I don't know how much more evidence we need. The banks, you know, went wallop, the government had to bail them out. We all kind of endured austerity to pay those kind of debts of developers and bankers. And yet we're still sticking to this model that doesn't work. It doesn't work for people to put a roof over their heads, which is fundamental, because unless you have a place to be, to call home, that is secure, that's decent, that it's warm, where children can grow up, they can make friends, they can be near their schools. You know, it is fundamental to exercising any of the other rights, like health, like housing, just like, you know, where we grew up. And I mean, it was interesting. I was chatting with my brother. I'm the youngest of a very large family, and he's at the other end of the family. I'm the youngest. But he was saying, you know, and he'd be no socialist, you know, by any means, talking about it. And he said, Colette, we were building houses back in the day. And, you know, there was people like, you know, Joe Murphy, we'll say, and he had a big family, but sure, you know, he had a council house, and then all his children went off to university. And, you know, it's terrible now that we haven't got that. Like, and even people who's perhaps wouldn't have kind of the socialist ideology or kind of, you know, value system can see that this is wrong. People are seeing that their young offsprings are working, their children, they have no chance. My daughter is paying 800 euro a month for a room in a house.
Yeah.
You know, and it's grand and she's lucky to have it. But like, you know, it's like, it's,
isn't that terrible that you just said it's grand and she's lucky to have it?
Yeah, but that's what she feels.
But that's what I mean. That's my point. Where the amount of people who I interact with
who say
to me, you know, I was freezing in the house. I'm in a house share and it's freezing last night, but I was on my way home and I was walking by people who are less off, and we're going, oh my God, we're on a sliding scale of just how shit it really is.
And that raises the importance of the argument about the right to housing, because the idea of the right to housing is everybody has an entitlement and should have the expectation that they can have in a wealthy society like this, an affordable, secure, decent quality home. Absolutely. And that, you know, and it is about raising expectations, because, and in a way, that's part of the, I think, the narrative around the housing crisis is it has been a homelessness crisis, rather than seeing it as a homelessness and a much broader hidden homelessness and a much broader housing exclusion and intergenerational, you know, rental, old age, you know, sort of multiple housing crisis.
Absolutely. I'm involved with a wonderful group in Cork called Young Knocknaheeny, and their focus is not housing, it's infant mental health. And it's it's like Sure Start in the UK. And it's a wonderful, wonderful a programme, a very a positive a whole series of everything from babbling babies to baby massage to all sorts of really lovely things.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can't cope with the numbers of people who are kind of wanting to link in with it. But they produced a report in the last a few weeks, which was kind of showing how housing crisis and housing poverty and housing precariousness is really undermining the work that they're doing. And there was 4 case studies, and they were saying there was many more. This is from their home visiting team. And like, there was one family living in an attic in, you know, with the rest of the family downstairs. It's damp, all sorts of respiratory issues. There was another family living where, like, there was, you know, panes had last broken. This was like a local authority property.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's been zoned for regeneration, it's not been repaired. So those children are living there in the here and now. You know, we can at least do the repairs, you know. And then there's lots of people who aren't eligible for HAP because HAP isn't, you know, adequate to finding a place. So those families living, having to move out of the city, out to the county, but their children's school is in the city. You know, one of the parents working on a 0 hours contract, and then, you know, surprisingly had kind of mental health issues, unsurprisingly had mental health issues. So, like, you know, this is a real crisis, and it bears down on individuals, because I know that Cork Simon recently did a study of, you know, the adverse childhood experiences. And I know there's mixed views about that as a sort of a barometer of mental you know, ill health and all of that. But it's, I think, a useful one. And basically it kind of counts the number of adverse childhood experiences out of 10. And if you have one, it means that certain things will bear down in you, not just in your childhood, but into your adulthood. But if you have four, you're in real trouble. And 80% of the people in Cork Simon had four or more adverse childhood experiences. You wouldn't be a rocket scientist to work that out. No. I mean, I worked that out when I was working there without this framework.
Yeah.
So, like, what we're doing is we're denying people their rightful expectation to a house and home, but also we are building up huge challenges for people into the future and the rest of their lives, and that surely has to be so unfair.
I just want to come in, and Rory used the word entitlement as well, and because I'm just conscious of people are going to shout at me now, and they'll come into my messages and say free houses and all that nonsense. We need to actually kill all that as well, because we saw again the highest number of people in the history of the state are at work. You know, we've seen that the highest tax take in the history of the state. This is not about people getting anything for free. People are working their asses off on limited hours contracts or whatever, and they're under huge emotional stress. HAP is bumping rents up for these people. It's subsidizing these private landlords, and this is just important that listeners understand that.
I think that's important. You know, when I use the word entitlement, it is not in the sense of, oh, we're entitled to this, so that we should get for free. It's about part of the social contract. It's the type of society we have where we say, well, we guarantee as a society everybody has this. Of course, people have to pay for it. They have to pay their rent. They do contribute to taxation. Everybody does. They contribute to their community. They're more likely to engage in their community to help, to be in a position to support, if they have a stable, secure, affordable home. So I think that's absolutely right to point out. It's not about this idea of a free home, but you know, and but I just want
it's
to
never
say,
been a free home.
No.
People have always paid their rent, you know, but if it's a council house, you know, this idea that it's free, or if you're in a housing association, as you pay your rent, you pay your dues. And of course, that's right and proper. So, yeah, it's not about anything for free.
In terms of that, because I know you were telling me you started doing your first year of a psychotherapy.
That's right.
Degree course. And, you know, coming from that angle, I think it's quite interesting for me looking at society, our society, and how we've changed so much and opened up. And, you know, coming from, you know, I grew up in the 1980s, you know, we were quite a reserved country and, you know, in a Catholic school. And the idea of talking about your emotions with your parents or with your family was just, you know, non-existent. And that we, you know, we've embraced mental health, thankfully embraced it and opened up. But what is interesting when I look at it is, okay, we notionally say, okay, we're all about talking about mental health and the impact. But yet, if we look at the housing crisis and lots of other issues of poverty and inequality, it's not framed in a mental health way. We don't think about, well, what is the actual impact on these people?
Absolutely.
What is the impact on us?
That's right. And you see that, you know, when you look at, say, the rates of mental ill health and suicide for travellers. Well, it's no surprise, is it? Like, if you're living in absolutely unspeakable conditions. I mean, Travellers as a group are far more hit by the homeless crisis than almost any other group, and Traveller Children in particular. You know, if people are, you know, casually racist and nasty to you most days, if you can't, you know, have a wedding without it causing consternation in the local hotel, or bury your loved one and have a gathering like any of us do. If you are, you know, go to school and school is a cold place for you, and if teachers don't understand your history and your culture and nobody else does either, you know, it is no wonder, is it, that you might feel bad about yourself. Mm. It's no wonder. So it's no wonder that those, and if you are 80%, you know, there's 80%, you said it's, Tony, it's full employment. It's like we've never had more people at work except for Travellers, 80% unemployment rate. I mean, it's like staggering when you think about it. Like it's, you know, how could this be? And so therefore, of course, if you haven't got the basics of life in terms of a place to call home, if you have no respect in the world, you're not respected in the world, and if school is not a route for you, as said, my dad finished school at 12, but all of us went to university, most of us did anyway, in my family. So, you know, there was a hope.
Yeah.
And if you
had social mobility.
There was a possibility, there was a prospect. If you don't have that and if you can't expect a job, it is no wonder then, is it, that, you know, that the suicide rate is 7 times the rate for the rest of us. And that mental ill health is ripe and rampant among travellers. And that's just a microcosm that happens outside of the traveller community as well. If you don't have a decent place to live, if you can't keep your children healthy, you know, if they're going into hospitals because they're living in damp conditions, because they've got terrible coughs, if there's no end to it, if every day is a complex day of, you know, and like the idea, and I was glad that the reports that came out on child homelessness from the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Housing and Children, you know, we must end at the very minimum, one night only this stays for
the
families.
Reports came out last week too.
That's right, which is unusual and significant, actually.
Yes, in terms of it's unusual and significant
because two committees came out on the same day with reports on the same topic.
Yes,
coming at it from two different kind of, I suppose, vantage points.
And these would
points.
Have been cross-party committees,
all joined to rock this committees. Absolutely.
Yes, so there wasn't a minority report. All even no. Fine Gael members.
No, they all signed
Fianna
up to
Fáil
it.
Agreed. So what were the recommendations that the Fine Gael members signed up to?
Well, there was many recommendations, but I suppose some of the standouts were the whole right to housing. As being something, an underwriting for children by the state, that they can expect to live in, you know, a decent home and have a roof over their heads, and asking the finance and public expenditure and reform committee to do its work, which was asked to do, I think, as far back as 2014, to examine the right to housing, which the Constitutional Convention supported. 84% voted of that convention voted in favour of it. That work hasn't been done yet. That needs to be done. Second is that to end the practice of families and children being in one night only accommodation. I mean, think about what that might do to you, to pack up your bits, your little belongings, such as they are, every day and move. I mean, like if you're talking about, you know, guaranteeing a life of insecurity and anxiety, what better way to guarantee that as a state than to ask people to do that? And I suppose in both of the reports, you know, it's build social housing. And that's in both of the reports. There's lots of other recommendations as well.
I think it was 14.
There were.
And I'm going to be cynical here now, and I think it's funny that a government party of government that's been in power for as long as they have, decide this is something that we'll sign off on a few months out from an election, because they can then put that into a manifesto in an upcoming election, that this is our commitment. However, I'm going to put my cynicism to side for a minute. I'm going to say there's a lot of good stuff in it, and as you say, it can create
momentum.
Yes, it can create momentum, and it's important that we were lucky enough to talk to the Children's Ombudsman in John Muldoon in this room, I think.
Niall Muldoon.
Yeah, yeah. And we had a great conversation about how, if you know, just putting children at the centre.
Yeah, but I don't think we should be putting our energy into like regulation of hubs.
No.
We shouldn't have hubs. And I think, you know, I don't, again, that's part of the normalisation agenda. You know, okay, we don't want hubs to be dangerous, bad places. But at the same time, the energies need to go into building houses and, you know, ending practices like the one night only stays.
But again, have to qualify when the state say build, they include in that.
Build and own.
Yeah, but they don't, like, what they call build is, well, if we sign up for HAP, that's done.
But I also think we need to, we're talking a lot about children, and this is hugely, the lack of housing is having a huge impact on children's daily lives. But you also think about older people, single people. Of the 10,000 people who are homeless, 4,000 are single people.
Yeah.
And like, if they don't have security of tenure, what is going to be their prospect into old age? You know, what happens to those people when the landlord decides to sell up and look for vacant possession? Like, you're 60, 70. I saw a friend of mine and he has always rented. Mm. And I saw him the other day and it just came into my head, you know, what security he's now, you know, heading into his 50s. He's working. He's a good job, but it's not enough to buy anything. He's not eligible for council housing. Mm. So he's reliant on the rental market. And I'm just thinking, what happens to him, you know, into old age? What if he has an accident? What if he can't work anymore? So the insecurity is for children, but it goes right through the lifespan and the life cycle. And that's truly worrying as well.
And it seems to me as well that there's another aspect to this, which is the whole, you know, climate change and, you know, how do we create sustainable low carbon societies and fundamentally transform our societies? And housing can be and should be at the core of that.
Absolutely.
And this idea that I think as well, there's two things that if you put housing central to climate change, you can actually achieve a just transition as well, because the whole issue of fuel poverty, people who are never going to be able to afford bringing their houses up to proper energy standards. And we think about the changes that need to happen, that, you know, a Green New Deal in housing seems to be, we're going to build, you know, hundreds of thousands of homes. We need to be retrofit hundreds of thousands of homes. The private market model will not do it on a sustainable basis.
Absolutely. And we need to build densely near cities. But then when you do that, you also need parks.
Yeah.
You need, places where people can cycle. So you need a whole series of things,
spacious apartments and homes.
Yeah.
Not,
high ceilings.
Not shoebox. Boutique hotels.
Exactly.
And
in the most recent CSO report,
or co-living.
Property sizes have shrunk again for the 9th report in a row, so they're just falling. So all of the new builds were down again. We're down another 1.7%. It's crazy.
It is, and I mean, but it's not as if this hasn't been done. Mm. We did well ourselves in as I said in the 30s and the 50s and in the 70s. We built houses. We built good places that were homes for people. But like, you know, we need to look to cities like Vienna. They have a very different attitude to housing. We need to look at places like Amsterdam. You know, it's a crowded place, but it's a place where people do live. Yeah. So we need to build dense. We need to be getting cars. I mean, I was recently visiting a member of my family who's just managed to buy a house. One of those rare people who's managed to do it. But it's out at the edge of, you know, Ballincollig.
Mm-hmm.
And like when we were passing by, there was two cars in every drive.
Yeah.
Because most people work in the city. So you know, talk about, like, as I said, again, lucky enough to be able to buy in the first place and just about manage it. But like, there's the joined up thinking doesn't seem to be there. And you look at other places and they do have the answers. And we don't, you know, it's important that we look to places like Vienna, places like Amsterdam, places like Hamburg. I mean, that was bombed to smithereens. And after the war, they built houses and they built good houses. And most of the houses are in, housing co-ops in Hamburg, even, and I know when I say this, people kind of, you know, shudder, but even places like Singapore, where there isn't a socialist in sight, they have managed on a small island to provide housing for everybody. And it's seen as a state responsibility. So they build and then they give people low interest state mortgages. So, you know, even if we are still wedded to the notion of home ownership, you know, there are ways and means that you can work that through as well. But I don't know why we're not kind of open to those ideas and suggestions. But I think it's a matter of political will. And even with 10,000 people now homeless, it's still doable. It's still tractable. And we must never, ever, ever get pushed off the idea that this has now become, you know, so big that we can't solve it.
And do you think there's something to look at around, and I know you have thought you're part of the civil engagement group in the Shannon, which is a technical group which tries to raise, you know, civil society and be linked with civil society issues, that we look at the area, you know, of broadly housing and homelessness, that, you know, we've had, you know, protests like Apollo House, we've had the Take Back the City movement. There has been significant, and there are ongoing kind of protests
and the
campaigns,
roofs,
and the Raise the Roof, you know, very large kind of alliance and campaign. We have the Home for Good campaign that you mentioned that we're part of, which is advocating for a change to the constitution and the, you know, the right to housing. But there seems to be, you know, there was momentum around each of those and then the momentum stalled. That, you know, where do you see that kind of civil society coming into this? Where, as you mentioned, like, where are the riots on the streets?
Yeah.
Or how can that be brought about, do you think? I'm not advocating for riots in the streets, but how can we bring about kind of civil society to really engage in this and pressure kind of the state and politics on it?
Well, we need to build a massive coalition. And I think that each of those kind of different ones are kind of, if you like, Home for Good is very much, you know, the voluntary sector organisations and the trade unions working together. So that's a particular sector. Then, you know, Raise the Roof is kind of a similar kind of constellation. We need to be harnessing people who would never, ever go on a march, who would never, ever go on a campaign. We need to be connecting in with renters in a massive way. We need to be connecting in with, I would say, industry, because I think, you know, business and industry is really suffering as a result of a lack of housing. So I think we need to make a massive coalition, and it could be unusual bedfellows in a way. But I think that is the only way that we are going to. And I think, you know, it's interesting. Jobs is the one area that seems to really concentrate the minds of government, you know, and there was a very activist, sort of strategy, around kind of job creation in, you know, after the crash. So I think that if we can make the link that, you know, we will not sustain our advantage or our prosperity from an employment point of view without housing. It's not my argument. It's not my humanitarian or my rights-based argument, but I actually think it's, so we need to build coalitions where different voices are coming together and putting massive pressure. So you have people, you know, in homelessness who are, you know, often so tired and exhausted that they haven't got time to be fighting, you know, the good fight, but they need allies to work and with them and where they can be supported. We need to mobilise the civil society organisations. We need to mobilise the trade unions. But we also need to mobilise, I think, people like employer groups, like IBEC, like others, and students and the renters. And I think that's where the critical mass is going to come from. We're not there yet. I think people are too busy kind of struggling. And I think people are too kind of confused, you know, your HAP and hubs and co-living. And the debate is very confused. And as I said, even the Land Development Agency, people who are well clued into the politics and public issues, you know, all of that kind of seems to kind of pass over people's heads. So I think we also need to be simplifying the debate as well and bringing it down to its core principles, which is, you know, people have a right to expect to have a secure home over their heads for across their lifetime. And the one of the key parts of doing that is public housing. And we need to be simplifying our messages and unifying people around that.
Oh, I think it's very, very well put. Colette, we're going to unfortunately have to come to a close. We could talk all day. Just kind of a summary, not summary, but I just wanted to get a sense from you in terms of, you know, as it's said from the outset that, you know, you have an aura about you, you know, you're driven, but you do it in a really, how to describe it, as I would describe anyway, not, what was the word you used, Tony, actually earlier, was humble way. And I think it's very, kind of inspiring to see a politician act like that, that it's not just about their ego, that it's actually about the issues that they're concerned about and approaching it in that kind of humanistic, as you say, way. Where do you get your hope and motivation from?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think, I suppose the referendum on abortion was a really kind of useful prism for that, because I was 21 when the Eighth Amendment went into the Constitution.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was devastating for us young women at the time. And it gave us a very strong message about, you know, where we fitted within our state or didn't, and our standing. And, you know, but at the same time, you know, within all of that, people still had, you know, we all had the little numbers for the BPAS, the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, in our little pockets. This is before the days of mobile phones. So we passed it around. And then when my friends and I went to London, we joined the Irish Women's Abortion Support Group, which is a very informal network of women. Day before, again, before mobile phones, we used to take calls from, we used to do work in a centre. It couldn't be an Irish centre because the government wouldn't approve of it. But it was a funded by the London Borough Grant Scheme at the time. So we used to do reverse calls. People would ring. We'd say, fine, give us the number. We ring them back. And we meet those women at train stations and our airports, and they'd sleep on our floors. And so what I'm saying, I suppose, is even if you're born into a theocracy, which I was, people always resist. And sometimes the fight takes a long time, but you have to keep fighting. And it was interesting, Alice Murray and myself, Alice Murray Higgins, were at a conference last week around about population and about development. And like so many people are looking to Ireland now because, you know, in that context around abortion rights. So things that seem impossible can become possible. And you have to keep the fight, even if the circumstances and all around you don't necessarily hold or agree with you, and you need to keep at it. We need to move faster on housing because of the material impact that it is having on people's health and well-being and prospects. But we need to keep making the arguments that we're making, have confidence in those arguments, and be prepared also for the long fight. So I suppose I take, you know, it was 35 years later, I was like 57 by the time that offensive article was taken out of the Constitution. So I think you also need to have, you know, the short-term energy, but also the long view. And, you know, also know your motivation. This, you know, this isn't right. People not having a decent place to live is not right. It's not right for people and for their children. It's not right for older people. It needs to be other. The market has failed well and truly, and we need to look at new ideas and solutions, and it can be done.
Colette Kelleher, Independent Senator, thank you so much for coming in and joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for asking.
Thanks for listening, folks. Do head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We do need this support. And I'll just finish on, thanks, Colette, and keep fighting.